Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday the 18th of September. Today, Gordon Brown's uttered the C word, cuts, and between now and the next election, how and when to reduce public spending will be the subject of much more debate. To talk about it here in the pod today are Guardian Daily's Friday guests Seamus Mill, The Guardian's columnist, and Ashley Seeger, our economics correspondent. Well, one possible area that's ripe for the chop is the Trident nuclear programme. The Guardian reveals today its true cost.
The total of the two large procurement projects will be £130 billion, according to Greenpeace.
And Barack Obama hopes for greater cooperation with Russia after scrapping America's missile defence shield in Eastern Europe.
Our new approach will therefore deploy technologies that are proven and cost-effective, and to counter the current threat, and do so sooner than the previous program.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, it's the news headlines with Bill Overton.
The new head of the army, General Sir David Richards, has warned against giving up the war against the Taliban. It was his first speech since taking over his new job after commanding NATO forces in Afghanistan. He argues defeat by the Taliban of the most powerful alliance in the history of the world would have an intoxicating impact on extremists worldwide. Sir David also says the military must worry less about using old-fashioned weapons such as aircraft carriers. And Greenpeace reports the cost of replacing Britain's Trident missile system will cost nearly £100 billion. As we'll hear later in Guardian Daily, ministers have said it would only cost £20 billion, but Greenpeace has worked out the total expenditure needed over the 30-year life of Trident. In Brussels, European leaders have ended their meeting with a decision to make a global deal to limit bank bonuses. They'll put their proposal to the G20 summit in the USA. The president of the European Council of Ministers is the Swedish PM, Fredrik Reinfeldt.
The bonus bubble burst tonight. Banks, some of which owe their very survival to massive support of taxpayers' money, should not be able to take advantage of good results in the future, pretending that the crisis was only a minor setback. This would be a provocation against the citizens of Europe, especially in face of the steep rise in unemployment.
Swedish Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt there. The European leaders also agreed to carry on a coordinated policy to revive the world economy. Meanwhile, the recession continues to bite in Britain. The Charity Commission says it's hitting income while demand for help increases. The Commission suggests charities should help each other to survive the downturn and even consider merging. President Obama's decision to scrap the missile shield plan gets onto the front pages of several morning papers. We say his acknowledged U-turn is seen as an overture to Moscow. The Times version is he's gambling on Russia making concessions itself. The Financial Times warns the move has triggered dismay in Central Europe and among Republicans on Capitol Hill. But the Times quotes President Obama saying the new policy will provide stronger, smarter and swifter defences of American forces and America's allies. Our paper follows up its exposure of the British oil company Trafigura, paying compensation to victims of its toxic dumping in Ivory Coast. We report the leader of the Conservative Party in the House of Lords, Lord Strathclyde, deciding to leave his post as a non-executive director on a Trafigura company subsidiary. The Daily Express claims thousands of people with heart trouble are dying unnecessarily because doctors fail to prescribe statins. And the Telegraph returns to its campaign against MPs' expenses. It quotes the new Speaker of the Commons, saying his team will be able to identify MPs who flip their homes and get more payments than they should. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Guardian commentator Seamus Mill and economics correspondent Ashley Seeger are here. We're going to be discussing how, why and where to reduce public spending. But first we'll hear from Julian Borger, our diplomatic editor. Barack Obama has abandoned America's missile defence shield in Europe. Obama told the leaders of Poland and the Czech Republic plans to site missile interceptors and a radar station in their respective countries had been dropped. Russia claimed the project wasn't aimed at Iran, as Washington had claimed, but was in fact targeted at Moscow and its nuclear arsenal. Here's what the American president said about the system that will replace the missile defense shield.
This new ballistic missile defense program will best address the threat posed by Iran's ongoing ballistic missile defense program. Our new approach will therefore deploy technologies that are proven and cost-effective and that counter the current threat and do so sooner than the previous program.
Our diplomatic editor Julian Borger is here. Julian, this is a big break from the George Bush era.
Absolutely, yes. This was one of the sacred cows of the Bush era. They really pushed setting up this missile defense in Eastern Europe as a shield against a future Iranian missile threat. And the Obama administration has taken another look at it and decided that it is an unproven technology against an uncertain distant threat and definitely not worth the cost in terms of resources, but also the cost in terms of the damage done to the US-Russian relationship to go ahead with it.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the cost. We'll be talking later on in the show about the cost and the effect on the US budget. But why has Obama made this announcement now?
He's under a lot of pressure. He's under pressure to improve the Washington-Moscow relationship for a number of reasons. The niggling disagreement over the missile defense system was holding up arms reduction talks that are underway now. It was an irritant in those talks and would have been a barrier to further talks and reducing, making further deep cuts in US and Russian arsenals, which is a strategic aim of the Obama administration. Plus, he would like to get the Russians on side when they meet the Iranians 1st of October. They would like to put maximum pressure on the Iranians and threaten them with a united Security Council and the potential for further Security Council sanctions with Russian-Chinese support. That would certainly be much more effective in terms of leverage than threatening Western-only coalition of the willing sort of sanctions. Whether they'll get that in return for abandoning the missile defense shield is yet to be seen.
Because Russia hasn't given any indication that they're prepared to make any concessions at all.
Yes, really the ball's now in Russia's court. They could decide that this is an opening to a new, more cooperative relationship, or they may see it as a sign of weakness, pocket the gain that they believe they've made, and push for more. And that would definitely be a severe blow to Obama, both in terms of his global agenda, but also his standing at home.
What's your hunch? What do you think Russia will do?
I don't really have hunches about Moscow, about this Kremlin. They're unpredictable and sometimes decide two things, contradictory things at the same time. So they are a difficult setup to predict.
What about the Eastern European countries? Will they now look again at their relationship with America and Russia and maybe think that they kind of sided with the wrong superpower?
No, they definitely won't think that. They will think, and they have voiced the sentiment that they've been let down here. This is a U-turn that has let them down. They are very sensitive to the idea of being an integral part of NATO, being under NATO umbrella and not dispensable as they have been before in history. And so they'll be looking for compensation of some form, a greater US-NATO presence in military exercises in Poland and Czech Republic, for example, or Patriot missiles, short-term, sort of short-range anti-ballistic missile systems. That's what the Poles are asking for. They will want some sign, some gesture from Washington to show them and their publics that they haven't been forgotten.
Julian Borger. I'm with Guardian commentator Seamus Mill and Ashley Seeger, our economics correspondent. Ashley, presumably the scrapping of the missile defence shield will delight the US Treasury, which is looking to cut America's defence budget.
Yes, it is. Many major countries who've bailed out their banking systems and have suffered this huge recession are all looking to cut costs everywhere. And you hear discussion in Britain of cutting things like Trident and other big projects, although they won't save huge amounts in the medium term, but clearly there's the race is on to reduce spending and probably to raise taxes to rein in these huge budget deficits that have grown up around the world.
Well, we've just heard about Obama scrapping America's missile defence system. One of Britain's biggest defence projects is what Ashley just mentioned, the Trident nuclear missile system. The Guardian reveals today it'll cost far more than the government has previously admitted. Our security editor, Richard Norton-Taylor, has the details.
Well, Greenpeace has come up with an in-depth study, really, of the cost of Trident and of the two large aircraft carriers that the government still insists it's going to go ahead with. The Trident missile system, or the decision to replace Trident with another similar system of ballistic missiles using
US missiles and British-built submarines, according to the government, will cost up to about £20 billion. But over 30 years, and including the cost, the full cost, the running costs, and all the surface ships and aeroplanes that will be needed to help protect it directly or indirectly, will cost a staggering £97 billion over the 30-year workings of the new Trident system. Well, very, very large aircraft carriers, the largest ships ever built for the Royal Navy, which the government also wants to go ahead with, plus the very expensive US-made fighter jets. Anyway, the total of the two large procurement projects would be £130 billion, according to Greenpeace. And the government puts it at significantly lower than that. Privately, there's a lot of people in the Ministry of Defence think that replacing the Trident with a sort of huge new missile system from ballistic missiles put on submarines is actually unnecessary, especially with one, because the defence budget is so squeezed anyway, and secondly, because the enemy in the foreseeable future, this is the government's argument as well as defence chiefs, will be insurgents and Taliban-type gangs of terrorists and so on, which won't be deterred and couldn't possibly be used targets of a long-range ballistic missile.
Richard Norton Taylor. I'm with columnist Seamus Milne and economics correspondent Ashley Seeger. Seamus, governments all over the world are looking for areas to reduce spending.
Yeah, I mean, the issue really is, I mean, first of all, how early to start to tackle the budget deficits. I mean, there's a debate going on in Britain at the moment, which has basically switched the focus of discussion and argument completely away from the crisis and its impact and unemployment and the social misery that it's causing, to the costs of paying for the banker's failure and the market failure that was the credit crash. And I think that, you know, at the moment, the argument's all being posed in terms of cuts and whether or not to start now or in a year's time. And that's a sort of politically driven thing. But I think from a real point of view, there's a big danger in that agenda, because it firstly could worsen the recession. It could actually have a negative impact on government finances, because there's evidence that if you cut public spending during a crisis or during a recession, you can actually end up worsening your deficit. But then there's a wider question about how far you need to cut if once growth resumes, whether you can rebalance or improve the finances and the deficit by slowing down the rate of spending growth rather than actually cutting. There's the kind of alternatives we've got that you've talked about already to do with Trident and other expensive projects. Then there's also the question of whether or not the people who actually caused this crisis in the first place, the richest part of the population, who pay generally very little tax indeed, whether actually the more socially just and the more economically sensible route would be to start getting them to pay some of their fair share to help improve the government finances.
Well, I would largely agree with all of that. Yes, I certainly wouldn't start tightening fiscal policy till 2011 at the earliest. And really what you need as a government is a credible plan over 5 to 10 years to narrow the deficit. You don't want your bond markets getting frightened and pushing up the interest rates that you have to pay. But I completely agree that it's a shame that ordinary taxpayers look like they're going to have to pick up the bill for the crisis brought about and brought upon us by these bankers. I completely agree that the rich should pay more of their fair share of taxes.
There's more from Ashley and Seamus in just a moment, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Let's just hear about some other stuff on The Guardian's website today. In Defence of Cliff Richard, that's by Bob Stanley at guardian.co.uk/music. The Big Issue, that's the magazine for the homeless, it's 18 years old now. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/society. And John Krasinski from the American version of The Office is being interviewed at guardian.co.uk/G2. I'm John Dennis, I'm with Seamus Milne and Ashley Seeger. In a speech to the TUC this week, Gordon Brown relaunched his premiership once again by finally uttering the C word, admitting that spending would have to be cut.
We will be cutting costs where we can, ensuring efficiency where it's needed, agreeing realistic public sector pay settlements throughout, selling off unproductive assets we don't need to pay for the services we do need. Labour will cut costs, cut inefficiencies, cut unnecessary programmes, and cut lower priority budgets, And when our plans are published in the coming months, people will see that Labour will not support cuts in the vital frontline services upon which people depend.
Well, public debt has mushroomed because of the global recession, of course. Next week, Gordon Brown will get another chance at relaunching his premiership at a summit of G20 leaders in Pittsburgh. Ashley, will the G20 leaders agree a deal on regulating the banks?
I think the G20 is backing away from a lot of this, unfortunately. I spoke to Tim Geithner recently, the US Treasury Secretary, who favours tighter capital controls on banks, and fair enough, but he's backed away entirely from any kind of cap or tax on bonuses. And I think that's a shame, because the further we get away from this crisis, the less will be the impetus to do something about the excesses of the banks that led us into this mess in the first place.
Seamus, why is this? I mean, it's the golden opportunity, isn't it, to crack down on the banks, and yet the leaders are failing us in this.
Well, I mean, it has been a colossal failure, and it is a really huge lost opportunity. I'm not quite as pessimistic as Ashley in the sense that I think that when the crunch starts to hit people, not just those who are losing their jobs right now, but when people start to be hit in their pockets in a serious way, and they realise that they themselves are bailing out the banks and their excesses and failures, I think the pressure for change will build, both for higher taxation on the wealthy, but also a much tougher regulation on the banks. I mean, I think the most serious problem is in Britain is that the government stopped short of taking full control of the banks that it took big stakes in, and therefore hasn't been prepared to use them to drive up lending and prevent the continuation of the credit squeeze, which is what we have at the moment, which is actually worsening the recession. So on a number of points, I mean, I think the opportunity has been lost, but I don't think it's lost forever.
Ashley, what did you make of the latest commentary by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which said that Britain's facing the tightest squeeze on public spending since the 1970s?
I think that's probably right, unfortunately, if you think that the load all has to be taken on spending cuts rather than tax increases. But I think the IFS is saying actually that it's either spending cuts or tax increases or a mixture of both. I think they're talking about the fiscal tightening overall. And I'm sure, unfortunately, that they're probably right. Although I would say, although this crisis has led to a much bigger deficit, we've been warning on this paper since about 2003 that the deficit was going in the wrong direction. Remember, Labour got themselves into a position of a surplus back in 2000-2001, but let it slip because they never matched their receipts with their spending. And that's okay for a while, but it means you went into this crisis in a much worse sort of overdraft position, if you like, than we should have been.
Well, the IFS said that public spending will have to be cut by 3% a year in real terms. And it said, we haven't seen anything like that since the 1970s. Well, Seamus, there's been more troubling echoes of the 1970s recently. We've had dire warnings from union leaders this week at the TUC of strikes and social unrest, and we've also seen the far right marching in the inner cities. Are the 1970s back?
Well, the 1970s have a slightly exaggerated reputation. I mean, it's a little known fact that actually average growth in the 1970s was the second fastest of any of the last five decades. So the idea that it was a complete economic basket case is wrong. But obviously there was a big series of crises in the 70s. And one of the lessons I think we should learn from what took place then is that the cuts programme that the Labour government imposed in 1976 was actually not necessary, that it went far further than it was required to, because they basically bought the story from the IMF at the time. And I mean, Dennis Healey, who was then the Chancellor, readily admits that now. So I think when we're listening to, you know, siren warnings from organisations like the IFS and, of course, the much more politicised ones from the Tory party, we have to be very careful of getting drawn into, you know, savage cuts in public services, which would be incredibly damaging to society and also could well turn out to be unnecessary from a fiscal and economic point of view.
I would agree with that. I do think that we do have to have a fiscal tightening of some sort. Seamus is right. We don't have to slam the brakes on right now, but we do need to put things back on a fiscal, a better sustainable path. Now, that might sound like economic orthodoxy, but for example, I used to live in Germany, and what you saw there was they'd run a big deficit for many, many years, partly as a result of unification. But it meant that I think one in six, one in every seven marks, that shows how long ago it was being spent just on servicing debt. So if you do run a deficit for too long a time, you restrict what you can actually spend your tax revenues on, because the deficit costs you a lot to finance. So it's sort of sound housekeeping, but I completely agree with Seamus that that some of these siren voices are probably overdoing it. As long as you tighten and get back to where you are, where you want to be within 5 or 10 years. This happened, you'll remember, under Labour. They carried on the Tory spending plans when they came to power in 97 and turned a record deficit from 1994 into a surplus within 5 years. And the economy kept growing robustly through that period. So it can be done, and I think it's worth doing, but it shouldn't be started very soon and it shouldn't be done too savagely. I quite agree.
I mean, Gordon Brown this week, Seamus, has tried to sort of reframe the debate a bit and sort of get back the initiative. He's uttered the C word, as we know, and he's talked about Labour protecting frontline services, which kind of sounds comforting, but what are frontline services? The voters really none the wiser after any of this.
No, I mean, he means health and education in particular. You know, you can see what he was trying to do. The bit about cuts in the speech was a very small bit, and there was a lot of other warm words about Labour's overall
cutting costs rather than cutting services. Approach.
Yeah, but I mean, I think there it is. I mean, basically, Cameron has manoeuvred the government onto his territory and has created the impression that the crisis facing Britain is one of public debt and the deficit rather than of slump, unemployment, bankers' failure and so on. And I think that's very damaging for the government. So although given what had happened in the last few months, certainly Brown had to reposition himself in some way, I think that allowing himself to be manoeuvred on Cameron's terms and being seen to dance to his tune is quite damaging politically. And if the story of the next few months becomes this story of debt and cuts and, you know, who's going to cut furthest and fastest, I think that's disastrous for Labour. And, it would drive the Tories towards a landslide. So I think Brown needs to reposition himself again pretty quickly, but it's going to be difficult.
Can Labour win the economic argument?
Well, I think it partly depends what happens in the economy and how prepared they are to take some more radical steps and measures that will actually appeal to their to traditional Labour voters who have, you know, are turning their backs on the government in droves. I mean, it's going to be very difficult at this stage, but I mean, it does seem to me absurd that And a brilliant political coup that the Tories have managed to reshape the argument in the way they have. And because it doesn't really reflect the reality at all, in my opinion, I think it should be possible to change that round. But the government is drifting and isn't really fighting its corner. So, you know, it may turn out that the Tories win that battle.
Seamus, Ashley, many thanks. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.